Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. After nearly a year of stump speeches and negative ads, after rally, now that the campaigns for governor have spent at least $30 million, it's the voters' turn.
I just think Strickland had some more. I mean, he had enough time to do better, but I just think we need to give him a little more time to see what happens. Because, Kasich, if he was with Wall Street, I don't deal with that. So
Strickland has not performed the way I anticipated, and I definitely think Kasich has got a better background.
Ohio voters are deciding whether Ted Strickland gets four more years to turn around Ohio or if John Kasich gets a chance to try to fix Ohio's economy. This hour, we'll look at the governor's race as well as other key races in central Ohio. Mary Jo Kilroy is locked in a very difficult race with Republican challenger Steve Stivers in a key race that could help decide which party controls the next Congress. And there are other big congressional races, a race for U.S. Senate as well, and a question to allow secret Columbus City Council meetings. Our guests this hour, two political pros, OSU political science professor Herb Asher. Welcome, Herb.
Good to be with you.
And Columbus Dispatch Public Affairs editor Daryl Rowland. Daryl, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. So the governor's race is a statistical tie. And that's fun to just talk about in the abstract, but in the in real life, that could wind up in the courts, right, Daryl?
Yeah, that's the ultimate upshot. Now, again, statistical tie, it depends on which poll you're looking at right here at the end of the game. The Ohio poll has Kasich up by a little bit more than 4 points. That is outside of their margin of error, so they are predicting an outright Kasich win. The Dispatch poll on Sunday, we had Kasich by 2 points. That was within our margin of error. And yesterday, Quinnipiac University had Kasich by 1 point, obviously within theirs. But, right, if this is super close, and I still think the odds are probably against that, but if this is, I think Ken Black, the former Secretary of State, once coined the phrase, within the margin of litigation. There are so many votes that are not even counted until after the election, about 3% in 06 and 08. If it's well within that 3% margin, first of all, we're not going to know election night. We have to wait 10 days till the provisional ballots are counted. We have to wait till the overseas civilian and military ballots get back and they're counted. And then we see where we are. If we're within 0.25%, then we recount. And if, like we did in the 15th Congressional District 2 years ago, if it comes down to provisional ballots, both sides have plenty of attorneys right at the starting line, and we could have a judge possibly deciding it, which I'm not sure anyone wants.
Right, Herb, they have people out at the polls today watching every move.
That's correct.
Looking for mess-ups.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think you have to have a super close election to start then having this post-election campaign, which is the post-election legal campaign. It's not likely to be that close. If it's, you know, if it's a 50,000 vote difference, that probably is a difference that stands up under any kind of scrutiny. So the real question is it a 500 vote difference? Is it 1,000? Is it 2,000 or whatever? That's not very likely. But the last polls that were done suggested actually a very close outcome today.
How many votes are we talking about when we say the difference between, if it's less than half of a percentage point or less, how many is that? Daryl, do you know?
Well, of course, that depends on turnout. But, yeah, it would be, a few thousand votes, I suppose, just generally speaking.
Okay. And is this unprecedented in terms of how close it is, or is there something we can look back to?
We've had very close elections in the past. I think when Jim Rhodes defeated John Gilligan, I think that was an 11,000 vote margin. We've had close statewide races. And, of course, if you go back to the presidential race in 2004, it turns out that George Bush had about 118,000 vote lead. If that lead had perhaps been something closer to 18,000, we still could be in litigation on that race because there were a lot of issues that were raised. But again, I think we have a fairly well-run election system in Ohio. I don't think we're going to hear lots of allegations about fraud or misbehavior or whatever. I think if it is a super close election, then we are going to have to focus, as Daryl said, on the provisional votes and how they're counted and the overseas and military votes and all of that. And it will take time. But again, I think that's a very unlikely outcome. But should that happen, we have a much better election system here in Ohio than, for example, Florida had back in 2000.
Right, and I just double-checked the figures. That would require an election within about 10,000 votes. If you assume Secretary of State Bruner's predictions are correct, that half or a little bit more of Ohio's 8 million registered voters will vote. So out of, you know, again, round numbers, 4 million votes, it'd have to be within about 10,000.
So much of what's been going on in the past week is get out the vote. You got to get out the vote. Herb, how much of a real impact are those things? Haven't people a week ago, I mean, who's going to be inspired to vote now who hadn't been inspired before?
Well, actually, there are a lot of voters who, okay, in fact, do not participate in early voting, who actually like the idea of going out to vote on Election Day. It's a civic ritual and all of that. But keep in mind, with our early voting, the get out the vote effort is not a 13-hour effort on Election Day. It's been a 35-day effort. And I think Democrats have said that without early voting, they probably wouldn't have had a chance this year. So the real question becomes, how good has the ground game been for both political parties? And I think it's particularly more important this year for the Democrats, because everybody's talked about the enthusiasm gap and how Republicans are energized and motivated and Democrats perhaps less so. But the Democrats now have had 35 days to get voters out. And now, in fact, here's the last day, the very last day. It's the get out the vote on Election Day.
And Darrell, how have the Democrats done?
I think they've done really well. We actually asked in our poll Sunday, if you have cast a ballot, and of course you can use your crosstabs and see who's sort of winning that early voting battle. And perhaps to some people's surprise, Governor Strickland appears to be up by about 8 points among early voters in Ohio. And two things there. One is that the urban counties are the ones that are encouraging early voting much more, encouraging as in sending out applications and in some cases paying for the postage for returning ballots. Number two, obviously, those are predominantly Democratic counties, so we may have more of a disproportionate return from more Democratic areas is what I'm trying to say. So, but, hey, it's better to be up coming into Election Day than being down.
Yeah, but one of the challenges in interpreting what that really means are that the Democrats who voted early, are these Democrats who would have voted anyway on Election Day, or are these Democrats who perhaps are what some Democrats would call sporadic voters, and that the Democratic Party has done a very good job of getting, in a sense, less intense and weaker Democrats to vote early? If it's the latter, that's very good news. If it's the former, it doesn't make too much difference whether you vote earlier on Election Day. A vote's a vote. And that's one of the challenges that the pollsters have had this year, is how do you really calculate the likely electorate? So I think, again, it's not just the Democrats do have an advantage in terms of the early vote. But if it turns out these are people who would have voted anyway on Election Day, it's not as big an advantage as it sounds. But if they've managed to get out people who normally would not vote in a midterm election, then that's a tremendous accomplishment.
If all the Democrats and the Republicans get every registered voter they can out to the polling places, there's still those independent voters that are really what swing these elections now one way or the other. And, Darrell, how have they done with them?
Former Congressman Kasich seems to be doing really, really well among independents. But I'm not sure that is the playing field anymore.
Okay.
And I mean, a lot of people, if you go by voter registration, there's far more independents. But when it comes right down to it, most people at least lean Democrat, lean Republican.
Okay.
So the true independent, I'm not even sure that makes 10 or even 15% of the electorate. So I think in Ohio, the way it is now, you talk about every registered voter getting out, that would be a Democratic victory, because they would have overcome this much ballyhooed enthusiasm gap. They would have gotten their people to the polls. And I think at this point in Ohio, there are more Democrats than Republicans. So every calculation we make is kind of against that backdrop.
Yeah, I think Darrell's absolutely correct. And I thought the Quinnipiac polls that got a lot of coverage in media here, they typically had that the largest share of their respondents were independents. That's nonsense. As Darrell said, I mean, if you look at Democrats, Republicans, and unaffiliated based upon voter registration statistics, unaffiliated is the largest group. But in fact, a lot of those unaffiliated are actually really Democrats or Republicans, but have never bothered to vote in the primary. So the real way to find out whether or not whether a person's a Democrat, Republican, or Independent is to ask them, and then to actually, which we do in polls, and then if they say they're an Independent, ask them, well, do you lean more to the Republicans or more to the Democrats? And then you find out that the pure Independents, you know, the group that Daryl was talking about, is probably only about 10 to 15%. So again, they can be an important group, but I think it really is the case that it's the people with partisan predispositions that really are the key voters in this election. And if the Democrats could do a good job, there are more Democrats in Ohio, the Democrats could actually win these elections. But that's really the challenge here in terms of getting out the vote, overcoming the enthusiasm gap, which seems to be helping the Republicans.
You know, there was a story yesterday or today with New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg saying that he thinks that an Independent, I guess it was yesterday, might have more success as president than a Democrat or a Republican. And I'm not quite sure whether he meant more success getting elected or more success governing.
Well, the interesting question is we're finishing this election, and there's nothing about this election, particularly at the national level, that bodes well for governing over the next 2 years. And so the sad thing would be if, in fact, tomorrow we start the 2012 presidential campaign where, in fact, everybody is sort of locked into place. I mean, already we've seen on the Republican side Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, saying no cooperation, you know, opposition for the next 2 years. Speaker Boehner, and I think he will be the Speaker of the House, has a lot of members who are saying, well, we're not going to compromise. And so you could imagine gridlock for 2 years. And if the economy doesn't improve, and if, in fact, Washington seems even more dysfunctional, and now you have a Republican Congress or at least a Republican House to share some of the blame and responsibility, you could imagine in 2012 that there might be an American population more receptive to a third-party presidential candidate. And I think that kind of candidate would have some libertarian elements and would probably be a fiscally responsible, sort of a Ross Perot kind of person, but might be socially moderate. And could that happen? Well, it's not very likely. Election laws are written to benefit the two major parties. But it may be the case that if, in fact, we spend the next 2 years in bitter partisan warfare – and the economy doesn't recover, then, in fact, it will be a plague on both your houses. And, in fact, actually, the polling this year has basically demonstrated that. The Democrats have the misfortune of being in power in bad times. But when you actually ask people about the Republicans in Congress, some polls actually show the Republicans in Congress are actually less popular than the Democrats in Congress. But the Republicans aren't in charge. The Democrats are. So they take the responsibility and the blame on this.
So it's kind of like a pox on both your houses, especially who's ever in control of the house.
That's right. And by 2 years from now, it could really be a plague on both your houses. Yeah.
Okay. We have to take a quick break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch and OSU political science professor emeritus Herb Asher. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Will former Congressman John Kasich be Ohio's next governor, or will Ted Strickland remain in office? The answer will be known tonight. Join WOSU and NPR News for an election night special. Listen tonight beginning at 8 right here on WOSU 820, or follow our up-to-the-minute coverage on Twitter at WOSU News.
Support for WOSU comes from Columbus College of Art and Design. Creative Futures begin in Saturday morning art classes for children and youth starting in January. Information and online registration at www.ccad.edu.
42 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:20 this morning. Sunny skies today for Election Day and a high right around 52. Clear skies tonight and a low of 32 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Today is Election Day. Don't forget to vote. But today is also the day voters get their say and payback for months of this.
It's the revolving door between Washington and Wall Street, and Congressman John Kasich stepped
right through. Ted Strickland, 4 years of talk, 4 years of failed policies, 400,000 jobs lost.
Kilroy put her personal interests ahead of the taxpayers' interests and drove annual...
It's Stivers who supports bad trade deals and corporate tax loopholes that ship our jobs.
The negative ads stop today. So, Herb Asher, Daryl Rowland, did the negative ads work, or were they just canceling each other out?
Well, I'll answer quick. Then I'll let the professor give you the full answer. My equation is pretty simple, and you've heard this for years as well. They wouldn't use it so much if it didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, we can hate it as much as, we say we do, but as long as that keeps moving the needle more than a positive ad campaign, the political consultants are going to give that advice, and unfortunately, those are the kind of ads we're going to be seeing in our mailboxes and hearing on the radio and seeing on TV.
Yes.
Well, I think to really understand if they worked, we really have to see the internals of polls. For example, did perceptions of John Kasich and whose side he was on change over the course of the campaign? You just can't simply look at who you're going to vote for. But Daryl's right. Look, campaigns believe these ads work. I happen to think, actually, that in the governor's race, as negative as it was, those ads were within bounds. They may have been irrelevant at times. Ted Strickland didn't lose 400,000 jobs, and John Kasich did not bring down Wall Street or whatever. But at least I think those ads were within certain boundaries of, reasonable exaggeration and all of that. I think we've had many other ads nationally for Congress, even here in the state of Ohio, some ads that really just sort of went out of bounds, if you will. And, of course, I know Joe Hallett described one ad on behalf of Josh Mandela as the scummiest ad in the campaign. And, Joe may have given out that award a little too soon because there were still a few weeks left in the campaign or whatever. But it is the case, and all of us say, oh, this is awful. These negative ads are terrible. They turn people off. Well, in some cases, they actually energize people. In some cases, they give people a reason to vote for one candidate or vote against another candidate. And I think we need to keep in mind here that in some cases, negative or critical ads are absolutely appropriate and should, in fact, be sponsored by candidates. Anne, if I'm running against you for office and you're claiming that you're going to run government like a business – and talking about your tremendous business skills, and I happen to know that you've bankrupted three or four businesses, I would be foolish as a candidate not to point that out, and I'd probably be doing a disservice to the voters in not pointing that out. Now, you would then say, oh, my God, Asher's gone negative on me. But I would say that's actually a legitimate critique, a legitimate negative ad. So one of the challenges we have here is how do you actually – sort through these things. And again, what's been nice is that the newspapers are doing a better job in terms of fact check and all of that, but most voters don't get to read those analyses of ads. And most of the ads are just talking about absolutely silly things. They're important things, but they so distort or overly generalize or whatever that a 30-second ad is not the way to have an intelligent discussion about issues of trade, about the economy, about a whole variety of things. So in that sense, this campaign has been dispiriting, but, as Daryl said, these ads work.
We welcome calls and emails from listeners. Call us at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Our question to you this hour is, what's the message you tried to send with your vote? What was your message you tried to send with your vote? Give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also contact us at Ann Fisher WOSU via Twitter or go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. Let us know, what's the message you tried to send with your vote during this midterm election? The negativity seemed to start. Now, I know they wouldn't use it if it didn't work, and it's with us to stay unless something drastic changes in our election laws. But it did seem to start earlier this year than others. Even I noticed it. Am I wrong, or am I imagining things?
No, I think you're correct. But also, too, it turns out that voting starts earlier right. too. So that we, in fact, started voting, what, September 28th, 35 days before the election. So what you really have here with early voting is you move up everything. And you move up the messaging, and you move up the media. But I think you're right. It started actually in July and August.
Yeah, actually, Governor Strickland aired a negative ad, I think, on primary election day.
Yeah.
And sort of went the at least mildly unconventional route of going negative right out of the gate against former Congressman Kasich, and didn't really come to some of those positive ads that, frankly, have gotten praise until these last few weeks in the campaign. That's kind of the reverse of the usual playbook.
But they get praise, but do they get the votes? Do they get the kind of results? And people will say that you know, they've been, so-and-so has been criticized for that. Why do they keep showing it? And that's, as you said, Daryl, it's a good sign that it's working.
Well, campaigns make judgments, and I actually think that playing sort of armchair quarterback and all of that, that I think actually the Strickland campaign probably, from my perspective, earlier on should have talked about some of the accomplishments of the governor. And you'd say, well, what accomplishments can there be when there's such a bad economy? But in fact, you know, Ohio is so different than California and Illinois and New York, New Jersey, in terms of actually having budget stability. And having a balanced budget and all of that, and supporting higher education, and that was a bipartisan accomplishment. That's not, that's something that the legislature had get some credit for also. But they didn't talk about that early on. And I think what was going on here is they said, well, look, not very many people know who John Kasich is, therefore we're going to define him early on. And so therefore they're going to define him in terms of Wall Street and and related kinds of matters. And and I think one could say, well, maybe you should have done both, done positive things about Strickland and done the definition of John Kasich. But it clearly, again, these are the campaign consultants saying, okay, you have an opponent who's not well known, therefore define him. And how are you going to define your opponent? Negatively, not positively, of course.
Daryl, Herb, what regions of the state do you think are going to decide this? Where they're losing the votes and where they're gaining them. Regionally, what does the state of Ohio look like now in terms of the governorship?
Well, I think everybody after the election is going to be looking at Northeast Ohio, but particularly Cuyahoga County and Cleveland. It looks like the Strickland campaign – well, let me back up. Northeast Ohio casts 40% of the vote. It is the Democratic heartland, if you will. And so the question becomes, how well do the Democrats run in that area? And I think people are expecting the Democrats to run very well in the Akron area and the Youngstown area. But Cuyahoga County and Cleveland, I think, is a major worry. One reason why it's a worry is that the Cuyahoga County Democratic Party, probably half of the elected officials in that party, have recently been indicted. There's a suggestion that there's not that much enthusiasm among the African-American community in Cleveland. People pointed out that the recent Obama rally at Cleveland State was only about two-thirds full. I'm not sure how significant that is. But I think people after the election will be looking at, okay, what did the Democrats carry Cuyahoga County by? 100,000, 75,000, 150,000. I think that'll be a major focal point. If the Democrats can get out the vote in Cuyahoga County, they're probably in very good shape. I think there's a belief right now, and polls are sort of indicating this, that maybe the Northwest Ohio, Lucas County, Toledo area is sort of coming home to the Democrats. So I think people are going to be looking really at Cuyahoga County. And then, of course, we always look at Central Ohio, Franklin County, at Southwestern Ohio, and Hamilton County and Cincinnati.
Daryl?
Yeah, I agree. Cuyahoga County is, that is the heart of Democratic strength in this state. That heart has been wounded. Obviously, some very significant Democrats are facing prison terms, and they're no longer in positions of power. Now, how does that shake down throughout the union halls and the ward leaders? And, the black churches, the traditional Democratic structure up there, that will be one of the big stories of this election. And I'm with Herb, analyzing that is going to be number one. Because I think it is indeed a story where, are the Democrats coming home or are they turning out? Has the party, which, the party leaders brag about how we have the best turnout operation here in Ohio, that any party does. So, it's really being put to test today and throughout the early voting period.
One group is the, you know, the college-age voters. They're not necessarily turning out in droves like they did 2 years ago.
We know that, in general, midterm elections have much lower turnout than presidential elections. And the decline in turnout is not uniform across all population groups. That typically when you get to a midterm election, who's most likely to drop out? Younger voters, poorer voters, less educated voters, all of that. So if it turns out that young people don't turn out, that will be part of a traditional pattern that we've seen in the last 30 years. So that's nothing new. Now, the question for Democrats is that many Democrats who got elected in 2008 may have won in part because of voters who were brought to the polls by the presidential race and the Obama candidacy. So if disproportionately they lose some of their supporters in the midterm election, they're in trouble. So, for example, whether it's here in Cincinnati or here in Columbus, you know, with Driehaus's race and Mary Jo Kilroy's race here, if it turns out that Mary Jo won largely on the well, not largely, but got substantial support from younger voters and minority voters and new voters, and those are the very groups who are less likely to turn out, well, then obviously she has a much more difficult path for reelection.
Because she's in a very, very close race again.
Yeah, well, Republicans will say it's not a close race. They're saying that's in the bag with former Senator Stivers, yeah. Yeah, I mean, certain quarters have already written off Congresswoman Kilroy and Congressman Driehaus. Obviously, the voters will have their say today. But I agree with what Herb was saying about the electorate. It's, you know, it's those infrequent voters, first-time voters. I mean, you know, we went out and talked to African-American voters, and, you know, Governor Strickland himself acknowledges, you know, there's no way he can match the enthusiasm of the historic election that 2008 was for the African-American community. So you try to minimize that fall off that Herb was talking about among minority voters, among women. One thing that's been persistent throughout the polling in this governor's race is a gender gap, a very significant one, double figures in some respects, where men are supporting former Congressman Kasich, women are supporting Governor Strickland. So, you know, if I'm a Republican, I want the men to show up. If I'm a Democrat, I want the women to turn out a little bit more heavily.
That just seems to be the pattern over and over and over again, Herb.
Yeah, that's been very common in American politics over the last number of decades, And some of it really is less gender per se than really it's economically based, that one reason why women may be more likely to support Democrats is that the Democratic Party has been more supportive of programs that might be helpful in terms of social safety nets and, women's health and things like that. But when you look at – compare men versus women – oftentimes people say the real comparison should be between married men versus married women, unmarried men versus unmarried women. And what you find here in the United States is that when you use the term single head of household, that's overwhelmingly women. There are not that many men who are the single heads of household. So among women who are single heads of household, they're much more sensitive to the kinds of programs that government supports that might help people in that category. And it's certainly been the case that the Democratic Party has been more supportive of those programs than the Republican Party.
Daryl, do you tease it out to that extent with the Dispatch poll?
We do not. We just do the gender idea, but, you know, there's only so many demographics you can ask. So, yeah, it's just pure male versus female in the crossheads.
Yeah, if you looked at marriage, you'd probably find that married women are just as Republican as married men, maybe even more so. So it's partly not gender, it's partly socioeconomic status.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at that at all. Yeah, that makes sense.
We want you to give us a call. If you can tell us what's the message you try to send with your vote, call us at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Rosemary, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Three reasons for voting. Why I did it absentee. Patience with the economy was about my vote for Ted Strickland. Ritz Cordray, really knowledgeable. I'm a fellow lawyer. And then thirdly, qualified members of the judiciary. And finally, just to send the message to my children that you can never give up on voting. It's your civic duty and you need to do it.
Okay. Thank you, Rosemary.
Thanks.
614-292-8513 if you'd like to tell us what's the message you tried to send with your vote. And Karen, what's the message you tried to send with your vote?
I haven't voted yet. Originally, I was for Strickland because it seemed like Kasich was going to win strongly. And then when the dispatch came out in favor of Kasich,
yeah.
Then that kind of disturbed me that they felt like Strickland wasn't strong enough. So I'm still thinking about it. My husband's voting for Strickland.
What's the message going to be, though, when you do vote? What are you trying to say with your vote?
Well, I just have a real concern for them, all my friends that don't have work. And these are people that are white-collar people that aren't used to not having a paycheck. And I think that's a real concern to me. I think that we need to have people kind of scoot over and make more work for everybody.
Okay, and Herb, what about that demographic?
Yeah, I think the caller just made a very important point, because in the past, when we had economic downturns in the United States and in Ohio, typically you focused on the manufacturing sector, and you talked about, oh, it was a manufacturing recession and people in manufacturing lost their jobs. And, of course, what we're going through right now is much more extensive. And so the caller mentioned white-collar workers, and in fact, all segments of the economy are hurting. So this is a very different kind of recession. It's deeper, more prolonged. You know, we are going through a recovery, but the recovery is a very, very gradual recovery that's not generating enough jobs. So I think the caller identified something very important there, that today the pain is being felt across more segments of the economy than typically it was in the past in a recession.
And, Karen, you had a question about judges' elections?
Right. And there was such a brouhaha where it looked like someone had bought the Supreme Court. Was it Kentucky? And I was wondering about when I'm going to vote for judges. I haven't heard anything much about anybody. Has there been no real...
This seems a little quieter this year. It does. Yeah. That's true. Good point, Karen.
Well, I think actually, again, the caller is raising a good point. The late Chief Justice Tom Moyer has really worked for many decades to try to change the method by which we select judges. And he really did not like this election system, didn't think that judges should have to be campaigning, raising funds, and really, he probably would have maybe preferred an appointive system, but like the federal system, but certainly preferred something called merit selection of judges, where in fact perhaps initially a judge might be appointed, and then he or she might be on the ballot where the voters are asked the question, shall this judge be retained and be given another term? But it is the case that by and large our judicial elections are low information races. Every once in a while, our Supreme Court races become very controversial, and certainly we saw that in the early 2000s, and we saw some really despicable campaigns.
It seems to have mellowed out since
then.
Yeah,
and well, in part it's because now one party controls the court and doesn't feel the need to, in fact, knock off some incumbents or whatever. But I think the caller's raising a good point. And twice, though, Ohioans have had the opportunity to change the system by which we select judges, and twice the voters have said no, that somehow you're taking away my right to choose judges. But in fact, when the choice is based upon name recognition or whatever, but not really based upon a lot of solid information, it makes you question, is this really the best way to select judges? And again, the former Chief Justice really wanted to change the system.
We have to take another break. Again, we welcome your calls. Our question to you this hour is, what's the message you tried to send with your vote? Call us at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll take another break. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
With over 100 films to his credit, Michael Caine knows a thing or two about acting, like how to look like you aren't.
If you're watching me give a performance and you turn to your companion and you say, isn't that Michael Caine a wonderful actor? Then I failed.
On the next Fresh Air, Michael Caine talks about his life and work. He has a new memoir. Join us.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Join WOSU Public Media and the Refectory for our first ever Chefs in the City wine tasting, Friday, November 19th at 5:30 p.m. Guests will sample hand-selected wines and taste exclusive creations by Chef Richard Blondon. You'll also be a part of a special WOSU TV production. A limited number of tickets are on sale now at WOSU.org/chefs.
Support for WOSU comes from the Midland Theater in Newark, with four troupes in concert this Thursday, November 4th, and Riders in the Sky, Friday, November 5th. Tickets and more performance details at MidlandTheater.org.
42 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today, a high right around 52. Clear skies tonight, a low of 32 degrees. Sunny for Wednesday, a high of 56, and there's a slight chance of rain Wednesday night. All Sides continues on WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guests this hour, Herb Asher, OSU Political Science Professor Emeritus. Herb, thanks again for being with us today.
Again, good being here.
And Daryl Rowland, Columbus Dispatch, Public Affairs Editor. Daryl, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Ann. Good discussion.
Let's talk about one that seems to be a foregone conclusion at this point, the U.S. Senate race between Democrat Lee Fisher, Lieutenant Governor Lee Fisher, and former congressman and other things, Rob Portman, Republican. Daryl, what do you make of that race?
Yeah, isn't it amazing? We're 40 minutes into the program, and this is the first we're talking about an open U.S. Senate seat.
Yeah,
that sort of says it right there.
Yeah.
Yeah, Rob Portman's got this in the bag, unless it's the biggest mistake in polling history. And I think it's just a very simple tale of that old saying of money being the mother's milk of politics. Rob Portman's got it. Lee Fisher doesn't. Lee Fisher had a decent primary tussle with Secretary of State Jennifer Bruner. He won, but it cost him money that pretty much drained his coffers. Former Congressman Portman, former trade representative and budget director for President Bush 43, was able to sit back and raise money throughout, and he is a very prolific fundraiser in a Republican year. So all those forces going together has just made what a lot of people a year ago were thinking was really going to be a really intriguing race. It's just been, kind of an afterthought this year, Ann.
Yeah, Lee Fisher spent a lot of money for relatively few votes over Jennifer Bruner, who spent pennies on the dollar practically compared to Lee and came very close. What happened, Herb?
Well, I think once Lee spent so much money on that race, the likely imbalance in financial resources in the general election became even more apparent. And one area in which I would be critical of the media, and this is a general criticism I make, is that media people oftentimes focus on what I call the horse race. And so the horse race simply is who's the viable candidate. And you determine viability by really two measures, how much money you have and what your standing in the polls is. And what was interesting is that when Congressman Portman did his first major media buy, it was about $1 million or whatever, and we had various polls that were being done. And at that stage, this is back in September, the polls were actually showing them within sort of 4 points. And in fact, at the end of his first media buy, I think Lee Fisher had actually narrowed the gap. But the dominant story in the media was Lee Fisher couldn't win, even though the polls were still showing it was close, because, in fact, there was no way he was going to be able to match the resources that Rob Portman had available to him. And I found that to be just a little bit of the media, again, doing this horse race, making judgments about candidates based upon the amount of money that they happened to have at the time. Now, it turned out the media were right, but there's also an element of sort of self-fulfilling prophecies here. You know, when the Quinnipiac poll came out with Strickland ahead by 17. I don't think there's anybody who actually believed the Quinnipiac poll was accurate. Got a lot of play actually in the Dispatch. And I think, you know, what you saw here, and then there were some other polls, you found the Strickland campaign actually beginning to leak some of their internals, you know, their pollster Diane mm-hmm. Feldman. And, you know, oftentimes I don't trust campaigns when they start leaking their own polling data. But I know why the Strickland campaign was doing that, because if, in fact, there were polls out there showing him down by 17, well, then you'd have lots of people saying, well, he can't win, and that's going to have some impact on volunteer enthusiasm, but more important, impact on donors and who they're going to give their money to. So I do think this year we were a little excessive in terms of the focus on money and poll standings and things like that. But that's just the way the game is and the way the media cover things. You know, if you look forward to 2012, there are going to be a lot of good Republicans who are going to be seeking the presidential nomination, trying to, you know, to defeat Barack Obama in 2012. And there could be 7, 8, 9, 10 Republicans running. How will the media decide which of the candidates to cover? I would hope they'd cover them based upon their quality, their intelligence, their issue positions and all of that. But I wouldn't be surprised if they don't decide to cover the ones who have the most money or the highest poll standings or the ones who are the most outrageous.
Daryl, that's kind of tends to be the way it is.
Yeah, and, you know, I realize Herb's critique wasn't just of the Dispatch or anything.
Of course not.
Certainly, you know, we covered many issues, an entire, you know, series of insight covers on where stood and everything.
No,
But I'm not, big picture, I'm not going to disagree a whole lot. And frankly, when you talk about who, you know, decide who to cover, and boy, 10 candidates, I don't know too many news organizations that has 10 people to send out 10 different ways.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
The way journalism is these days. On the other hand, money is just, you know, it's almost like that is one of the first races, is to build that bankroll, just because, you know, that is so important. Now, of course, all we have to do is think back, what, just 3 years ago at this point, it looked like Hillary Clinton and Rudy Giuliani were going to be the presidential mm-hmm. nominees because of those factors, because well-known names, good bankroll, seemingly mm-hmm. decent organizations. So it's not like it's, you know, there's an anointing that takes place and the inevitable then happens. I mean, we've seen that, you know, the contrast happen. But I think with Fisher and Portman, the contrast in bank accounts was just so gripping. And Portman has now run, I think, 12, 13 ads. Lieutenant Governor Fisher had one right at the beginning, and he's had just sort of a token few sprinkled here at the end. When it's just overwhelming like that, you know, like I say, we cover the issues evenly on those candidates, but we know every poll shows about our role compared to the role of 30-second ads. Unfortunately, we're a sad second place to that by a long shot.
We have some responses to our question, what's the message you tried to send with your vote? I'll run through some emails, and we'll get to a caller. Email from Travis. The message I sent with my vote is that we didn't hire President Obama for 2 years. We hired him in the Democratic Congress for 4 years, so why not give them more time to follow through with their vision of change? Also, it's crazy to think that Governor Strickland lost 400,000 jobs. We as Ohioans and Americans need to be more mature, thoughtful, and patient. From Bob, with my vote, I want to say that people should take voting more seriously so that they aren't swayed by stupid ads. From Gina, I'm appalled Mike DeWine in the Attorney General's race would join a lawsuit to roll back health care reform. I will vote for Cordray because of this. Of course, Mike DeWine, the Republican in the Attorney General's race, trailing Rich Cordray, said that if he were elected Attorney General to the state of Ohio, he would join the other attorneys general around the country that are doing battle in court over the health care reform. 614-292-8513. If you'd like to give us a call and tell us what's the message you tried to send with your vote. And Bob, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann, and guest. The message that I intended to send with my vote was, number one, I am human, fully human. And number two, I successfully completed middle school. Beyond that, as I have observed the campaign season and listening to all of the analysts and the pollsters, I made aware of how brilliant my high school government teacher was. She was a political scientist, but she elected to teach underserved children, and I fell into that category. And she taught that an informed vote is one that takes into consideration two generations past and two generations future.
Okay.
And that kind of, that level of critical thinking, you know, is just so obviously absent.
Okay.
And when we talk about the young people who came out enthusiastically in the 08 election, but now they are not there, you know, mm-hmm. absent, visibly absent, well, to me, that would signify a reflection on what they are not being taught, at least on the high school and college level.
Okay. Thank you, Bob, for that call. Let's go to now Chris. Chris, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Fine, thank you.
The vote, the message that I intended to send was that based on the background of the fact that I've been a registered Republican my entire voting life, but I've been so disgusted.
Sorry,
Republican
Chris.
Party.
Yep.
I'm breaking up?
No, I accidentally cut you off there. Sorry.
Okay. Like I said, registered Republican my entire voting life, but I've been so disgusted with the way the Republican Party has been acting the last, 4 to 6 years that I decided a couple of weeks ago that I was going to walk into the voting booth and vote Democratic just across the party line out of protest. Well, this morning I got up and I couldn't quite do that, but I did vote for Strickland based on the fact that I think he has more integrity than John Kasich does, no matter what John Kasich says. And I voted for Fisher for the Senate race just as a protest vote, just to try to keep the Senate in the Democratic hands to get something done, if that's at all possible. So
okay.
Mine was definitely a protest vote against the Republicans.
All right, Chris, thanks for your call.
Thanks
for listening. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org and tell us what message you try to send with your vote. And Sue, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for your program.
You're welcome.
I am voting on the basis of fiscal responsibility, and I am not a Tea Party person. I am a person who voted Republican for the first four presidential elections I could vote in, and then voted for Obama because I thought we definitely needed an improvement in financial regulation. I think the basic message that a lot of people are sending is listen to us when we ask you or send a message to you as to how you should do something. I think many people favored health care reform, but they wanted tort reform along with it because they are going to ask doctors to treat people for very little money but run the risk of horrendous lawsuits. And Ohio has a very good law. If you've got a catastrophic medical injury, then the limitations on damages don't apply.
Mm-hmm.
I think small business is saying, help us in the way we need to be helped.
So your vote is about that.
Right.
Okay.
I think it's mainly an issue, and that's made it very difficult because in the governor's race, you have Ted Strickland, who I think has tried to do something fiscally responsible in certain respects. And then you have someone who worked for Lehman Brothers. But on the other hand, in terms of which party has a history of restricting spending, it tends to be the Republicans.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Sue.
Thank you.
Take care. 614-292-8513. We have a very few minutes. And Thomas, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I just wanted to call in and say I'm one of these guys that voted basically straight third party. I wanted to vote, but I didn't want to support either one of these guys. I have big problems with both parties. Everybody running seems to have done something before, got voted out, coming back. They're mixing jobs up. It's like, go out and get a real job and then come back when you have something, you know, to say and do something.
All right. Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
You know, one issue I wanted to get to before we run out of time was what happens if you know, with the control of the apportionment board, what, you know, the importance of this election, the midterm elections every 10 years take on an added importance. Herb, why don't you talk about that and what could happen?
Okay, we have a reapportionment board that has five members on it. There's a legislative Democrat, a legislative Republican. They cancel each other out. Then we also have the governor, the secretary of state, and the auditor. And we will do redistricting next year. The question becomes, which party wins at least two of those three offices, governor, auditor, and secretary of state? And certainly the polls are indicating that governor and auditor are very close, and secretary of state perhaps is not quite as close. So whichever party wins that reapportionment board gets to redraw the state legislative district boundaries, and then the state legislature redraws the congressional district boundaries. We have tried on many occasions to, in fact, reform the method of redistricting. I was involved in a campaign in 2005 that was just clobbered. One of the candidates for Secretary of State, John Husted, right, has kept the issue alive. I give him a lot of credit, along with the League of Women Voters. So next year we'll look at the reapportionment board, see, in fact, who's on the board. If Strickland and David Pepper win, the Democrats control the board. If Kasich and Husted win, the Republicans control the board. Husted has said, actually, that even without formal change in the system, the board could behave somewhat differently. His Democratic opponent has said the same thing, Marilyn O'Shaughnessy. There's no reason why we have to be so partisan in terms of how we draw the district boundaries. But that will be an interesting thing to watch. And the temptation, of course, is that whichever party wins the reapportionment board has all of the political incentives to try to do in the minority party. And we'll see whether that changes. I don't think people are all that optimistic about that. But again, that's one of the things that's at stake in this election. And again, I think particularly with close races expected for governor and for auditor, that's another reason why people care about the outcome of those two races.
Now, when I started covering politics in Ohio 20 years ago, Darrell, they were talking about trying to change the system as they went into litigation over, over the redistricting.
Yeah, it's and I'm glad Herb had a little bit of cynicism there at the end. I'd hate for the journalist to, you know, have the entire cup full here. But, you know, in this case, I'm from Missouri. You know, I'll believe it when I see it, so show me. But, you know, noble intent. And I know maybe some seeds planted by that Reform Ohio Now campaign back in 05 will bear fruit in a few years. But, yeah, it seems right now that the Secretary of State's race is going Republican. That means we're down to two races that will decide, and Democrats would need them both to get control of the board, governor and auditor. Republicans win one of those races, they most likely will control the board. And then we'll see what happens next year once the Senate results are in.
Michael, you've waited a long time. I have about 15 seconds. What's the message you're trying to send? And sorry for the wait.
Yeah, that's okay. I don't think I'll get it all in. But four things. I'm just going to vote against the madness of the amnesia of how we got in this mess. Mm-hmm. A vote against the madness of the lies uncontested on Fox News, the madness of Republicans voting against Democrats on issues that are Republican, mm-hmm. and finally just the madness of the Supreme Court decision on the basis of a corporation. It's as mad as using that same root word, corpus, as calling naming a submarine after the body of Christ, Corpus Christi. So in the hands of madmen, for the first time in my life, as an independent who voted once for Kasich, I will vote all Democratic tickets.
All right, Michael, thank you for waiting. Thanks for your call. Thanks for everyone who listened. Thanks to my guest, Herb Asher, OSU political science professor emeritus. Thanks, Herb, for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Darrell Rowland, I know you're going to be busy all night. Dispatch State Public Affairs Editor, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Anna. Enjoyed it.
That's all the time we have. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820 NPR News.